everyone. It's Angela with the podcast Refocus with Angela Stevens. I am so delighted to interview my guest today. I think you might have heard of him. You might have heard of the organization, but I think you're going to really enjoy as I interview this individual and you're going to learn a lot. So today we are welcoming Sherman Gillams Jr. He is the Chief Strategy and Operations Officer for NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Let me say that again in case you've never heard of it. It's NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So Sherman, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's good to be here, Angela. Thank you.
You're welcome. So, okay, first of all, we were talking before the show, and I know this is all about focus, but we also want to know about you as a person, right? So you were kind enough to say that you weren't even familiar with what NAMI was, right? So tell us, first of all, what was your journey about going to NAMI? Why did you choose to take this role? Because you've been, has it been a year you've been with this company?
Not quite, about 4 or 5 months.
Okay. All right, perfect. So, and there's been a lot of changes and a lot of growth and everything with NAMI. So we can't wait to hear more about that. But so what was it that made you go to and join NAMI?
Well, it's a bittersweet reason. Last year was pretty tough for a lot of society. My role last year in the veteran space was to provide assistance and help connect veterans to care, particularly those with mental health issues. Veteran suicide has been endemic in our country for the last decade. So I spent the last year when everybody was on lockdown identifying individuals who are really in dire straits. And like most people, if you don't make your self-care a priority, it'll take its toll. And I think for me, I felt so helpless because there were many systems involved that just were failing in many ways that I couldn't control. I couldn't do anything about it. So when I actually had someone reach out to me about the job at NAMI, and I went and did my research on the organization, I'd heard from a distance. In fact, I did attend a conference that NAMI held that summer. So I was vaguely familiar from a distance. I was a fan. But when the proposition was presented to me to work there, it was really to help the organization move into, the next 5 years with its strategic plan and find ways to, expand its advocacy and lead the conversation in many ways. And I thought that was exciting. So I decided to take my 16 years in veteran advocacy as a senior executive and take a different role, try it out outside the veteran space and hopefully be more impactful.
Awesome. That's such a really a great story, because there's many people that don't know about NAMI. Mm-hmm. And it's such a wonderful organization because you guys have a lot of resources available, right? So what are, for somebody that might be listening to this that is not familiar with what NAMI has, what are some of the resources that they have? They have them actually for both professionals in the professional psychological world, but they also have them for individuals as well, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I'm going to answer the question this way. One of the first engagements I had was with the senior directors that would be under my charge, and I asked each of them, describe for me what you do for an individual who's in crisis. You just tell me, and then give me the full breadth, because I want to know how you impact people, not just the work that you do, but what the impact is. And it was great because they had to think through a lot of their work, not in terms of the effort, but in the outcome. And what I learned is that NAMI has benchmarking programs that provide education in different dimensions of life. So they have a program that focuses on the parents of children with a mental illness. They have a program for peers to talk to other peers. So this is somebody with, quote unquote, lived experience that is going to basically mentor another individual. There's another one that gets into the elementary aspects of mental illness so that people understand it's not such a mystery. It's not something, you did something wrong, right? Some cases it could be related to trauma and things like that. But in a lot of cases, it's just what happens. And there are upsides to understanding a mental illness, even when you have it, because then you can find different ways to tap into, for example, creativity and different ways of looking at life. And so there are a litany of programs, one that focuses on first responders, Homefront focuses on veterans. So it's like a library of these sort of very well developed programs that they measure a lot of aspects of impact within those programs. And then you have people who decide to become the presenters that were at first the beneficiaries of the intervention. So it's really exciting because it really puts an emphasis on valuing an individual's journey more than anything. And even if you've got, for example, schizophrenia, bipolar, any of those what they call disorders clinically, it doesn't have to be something that ruins your life. You can actually find a way to make it work for you. So I really enjoy the fact that we're not a bunch of doctors. We're not part of any health system, but we do, as you said earlier, we do provide resources for clinicians who may be in primary care and not in mental or behavioral health to give them a better understanding of what it means to practice with competency in mind. And by competency, sometimes that's cultural in nature. Sometimes it's, you know, there are other aspects of competency that get missed in medical school. So
true.
So we do a lot of that kind of work to help both the community of practitioners as well as the people who get treated by them.
Right. So I know that loneliness is huge right now, right? Especially with the pandemic and where we've been. Are there resources for people who are, you know, who haven't gotten out? You know, I was thinking about this the other day. You know, I'm married now, but what about the people who, you know, their children have moved on and they're single and they've been living alone? Is that a concern for NAMI right now?
Well, loneliness, and a lot of folks may not realize this, loneliness is considered one of the number one causes of suicide among service members. Not combat, not trauma, it's loneliness. Now, it's compounded by other things that could become a factor, such as financial issues or divorce or things like that. But loneliness was the common thread in a lot of these cases, even more so than deployment and all that kind of stuff. And of course, you can become lonely on deployment or lonely because of a divorce. But that was the one characteristic of any suicide attempts that seemed consistent. So as I think about what's happening in the country, I can't help but to think about how many people are in a home where they were told they had to be, basically sequestered off from society. And the problem is, it's almost like you're between the devil and deep blue sea. You either do the loneliness or you get sick. And that's not a good way to live. You're in survival mode either way. And so you had people making choices based on their level of loneliness and said, I'm going to risk it because I need to get out or I'll go crazy. And you did see a spate of suicides among people who just got tired of living that way. So I do worry about it. And it's real right now because we're going through something we've never seen before. And children are not going to school. And you have parents that are not sending their kids to school and getting time for themselves. So it does have a domino effect.
You know, and I was just going to say, it's not just adults, it's children, right? It's children. And, our company Refocus, a creative office, is, you know, our product is through a child's eyes. And as I was sharing with you before, sometimes as parents, it's important to stop what we're doing and really, really talk to them and say, I just need a few minutes, right? Do you guys recommend anything for parents, by the way, since we're talking about that with children, like what they can do? Do you got any advice for them?
I'm glad you asked that question because there's something I harp on repeatedly. It takes an average of 10 years to uncover a diagnosis in a child who's got a mental illness. So we're talking about by the time they hit age 14 and you start to see either the behavioral issues in boys who are hyperactive or in girls who are depressed and very sensitive, it comes across as growing pains in a lot of ways, but sometimes there's a mental illness that resides within that development. And it's not uncovered until they've gotten in trouble at school many times, or they've been put on medications, or have been dealt with by systems that weren't sensitive or acutely aware that there might be other issues other than misbehavior, for example. So I tell parents that while you don't want to, go on the different online resources and diagnose your child yourself, there is a point where if you suspect something and it just doesn't fit, you got to get them checked out and you got to go to a mental health specialist, not your doctor. They may mean well, but you got to go to a mental health specialist to make sure that you're not missing the early signs, which can be, again, covered up by adolescent and teenage woes. But suicide among youth is a real thing, and it happens because a lot of signs get missed. And the last point I'll make is it starts around the average age of 14, and you start to see evidence of things. Looking back on it, you say, well, yeah, that's what that was. But while it's happening, a lot of signs get missed, and it's about a decade that goes by before a lot of folks get the diagnosis.
Wow. I'm really touched by that. As I was sharing with you during the month of May, we wrote two guided anxiety journals, once for adults and once for young adults. And we're giving away 10 in the month of May. So sign up at time2refocus.com. That's time2refocus.com. And you can, and the answer is what, you know, how to handle stress. And then you just sign up and we're having a drawing. And it's really to promote mental health awareness because talking is so important. And kids don't talk. Boys don't talk. And so when we were writing it as a team, I'll never forget this. I had to share this with you. My intern was a 20-year-old guy, and we were picking out the cover, and it was a girl looking out the window. And he said, I said, what do you think? Because I asked all my staff. I said, you know, what do you think? And he said, you know, I don't know one girl that will carry that. And I said, really? Why? And he said, because girls don't want you to know that they're hurting. And I went, wow. And we immediately changed it. And it's a picture of a group of kids on it. Why do you think that kids, girls and boys, why do you think, you know, to me, if I had to guess, I would say because we've put this phone in their hand, right? And so their social skills, number one, are lacking. But what's your sense on that?
Well, I raised four daughters, as you know.
Oh, well, look, we'll just let you take over the show from here. Okay.
and I will say that around the turn of the decade, 2010, 12, social media really took off. And when you think about what social media does, it does connect you to people, but it also connects you to the fractures in society, like bullying, like body shaming and all those things. It does something else, though. It also takes an individual who might be suffering something that nobody knows about, and you start to compare yourself to the lives of people who can make up their identities. And so You can, you know, every peer you look at may look like they're having a wonderful life when in fact it's just made up, you know, profile. But when you compare yourself against that, you can never be good enough. And then don't even mention what happens on social media where people get very nasty and they say things. So I think that the expanded access to social media has contributed in many ways, especially with girls, to a lot of the spikes in suicide attempts around that time period. That's all documented in research. Now, if that's still the issue, I imagine that on top of other things, such as what we're going through right now and some of the isolation may be factors. But I would suspect that too much access to too many people who can judge an individual, I think it's especially pronounced in girls. As a dad who saw a lot of that and dealt with a lot of that with my girls.
Yeah. You know, one of the, as many people know, my son was diagnosed with ADHD in the fifth grade. I was diagnosed with ADHD at age 45. And usually there's another diagnosis with that, which is anxiety or depression or bipolar or whatever. I never knew I had it. So I have three businesses, so I probably need a lot of counseling from that. But anyway, but it's interesting because one of the episodes on our podcast here, I interviewed my son, and it's, I think, the second or third, and it's what it's like to have ADHD in college. And the thing that it was kind of saddened as a mother, and I was inspired by his advice. And one of the pieces of advice that he said was, in high school, if you do something, you're labeled. But in college, I meet somebody every day. With the pandemic, it's a different story, but he said, you know, it doesn't matter. Because you're going to move on. And I that came from him, not me. And so I was like, wow, that's inspiring, because that's true. Right. And so social media, it can consume you. And you're right. You can't compare to it. And we talk about that in the journal. But in terms of NAMI, what did they suggest for kids if it's really a problem? We had suggested turn it off, like just, you know, either be happy for the person that you're looking at or walk away. Do you have any advice for kids going through that?
We do have a resource for young people, Ending the Silence, where young people are engaged and talk to trusted individuals who have their well-being in mind. It is an online, I believe we're developing it for more online engagement, because a lot of this requires a human-to-human touch. But for, you know, COVID and a pandemic, it's kind of watered down the effectiveness of the engagement when it has to be through this electronic platform. But we're going to adapt, and a lot of the Ending the Silence work, we're going to find ways to deliver to teens. Now, teens aren't Zoom people. You know, they they connect in different ways, and they connect, you know, their TikTok and all that stuff. So we are actually talking to young people about the best way to connect with them through programs like Ending the Silence. But I would say anybody who is just, you don't have to be in a bad place. Go on NAMI.org and begin to look through all the programs, read the little descriptions, because I think that even if one program is ideal for you, you're going to find three or four, because all of us are sort of complex in our identities. And so while you may be a parent with a, you know, mental condition yourself, you may have a child or you may have a friend, you may want to be a peer, that kind of thing. So it's going to be a multifaceted opportunity to learn more, not just about yourself, but about how you can be effective with the new knowledge that you have. And a lot of that right now is on our page, where those resources are pretty easy to access. And the beauty of it is we have 648 affiliates around the country. So there's likely to be a live in-person opportunity to attend a, for example, a parent support group where, you know, I've attended one, and it wasn't meant to be the end all be all, but it sure as heck helped when I got to see other parents talk about what they were going through. And it gave me ideas on things that I hadn't tried in the pandemic.
Wow, so I did not realize that. That's amazing.
So there's a listing of all the affiliates that you can click on, and they'll tell you which programs are available in the area.
And we will put a link on our website on this as well. I could talk to you all day about what you guys do, because I'm fascinated. But I wanted to mention, you and I were talking about this, and I wrote it down. You have this program right now called Help Not Handcuffs. Is that right? Did I say it right? Okay.
Yes.
Tell us what that is.
So it's a four-part series where four different stories. It really gets into policy in terms of justice diversion and alternatives to pathways to the, you know, to the courtrooms and to jails. Mm-hmm. In the first series, the first part of the series, we focused on a program in Miami where a judge, law enforcement, and even former inmates who had made the turn were able to be a part of this sort of framework where a new offender comes in, they do their time, or they're given an opportunity, but they're not thrown out in the street to figure it out for themselves. They're brought into this support system, you know, and the judge is actively engaged. And when you think about what judges do, they make such a difference in the lives of people, ordinarily in a negative sense. But when you have a judge who's got the compassion that was put on display in that documentary, it was beautiful to watch. And then there's other parts of that series. It's a four-part series that may be at the fourth one right now, but we can provide a link to you for your listeners to click on that, click on those four documentaries. They're like mini documentaries with a specific focus on alternatives to justice involvement.
That's great. That's great. Now, I want to talk to you about focus, but I did want to ask you, we were talking and you mentioned, and I had mentioned that NAMI is going through a lot of changes right now, a lot of positive changes. Is that right? Because you've got, I believe you got some new staff on board. You're on board. Can you just highlight some of the changes that you guys are doing from where NAMI's been in the past?
Sure. Before the pandemic hit us, a strategic plan was crafted with a lot of stakeholders, a lot of the leadership, a lot of the outside folks who are invested in NAMI's mission. And so, and that's actually on our website. It's the 5-year strategic plan, 2020 to 2025. The problem is, you know, it's great to have a blueprint, but you have to have somebody build the house, right? And so I became the kind of the architect for how we structurally adapt to the expectations of the plan, with an eye toward three major areas, one being cross-cultural engagement, the next being justice diversion, and the third dealing with health in general. But the outcome we want to see is that people get help early, people get the best care possible, and that folks who have mental illness aren't criminalized and don't end up in the justice system, which is really the only place you can go if you're not given access to a mental health facility. The jail is the only place. So instead of sitting in somebody's living room and trying to treat the individual, a lot of folks end up in the justice system. So we have those three impact goals that are tied to a lot of the work that we're doing with youth and crossing cultures and things like that.
Wow. So I have so many questions for you on a personal basis. So this podcast is all about focusing, right?
Okay.
And on a daily basis for you personally, let's say you're having a really bad day or just, you're just off, right? You know, you got 55,000 things to do, right? But you're not there and you just can't pull it together. How do you, Sherman, how do you focus?
The one thing I learned the hard way is that self-care is part and parcel of being your best self. And what I mean by that, and if there's one thing I've appreciated about this pandemic, is the importance of sleep, having a clear mind, having your body recover. Because as a Marine for 12 years, sleep wasn't, it was a luxury. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you got too much sleep, you felt like you were behind. So getting up at 5 a.m, no matter what happened the night before, we took pride in that. That's what we do. But it doesn't quite work when you've got other obligations and your family needs you and you've got a job to go to and you're sitting on the road for an hour there and back on the interstate and you're just drained by the time it's over. And you can plateau, but you can't get better. And so I've valued sleep so much so that that I put it above watching TV because it's just TV doesn't do a whole lot for you except turn your mind off. But the other thing is also keeping incremental goals as a part of your daily walk. So I wake up every day with incremental goals that my to-do list used to be 50 items long and I never got through it. But I said, I want to get up and do 2 or 3 things today. They may build on other things and be subsequent goals, but if I get these done, I'm satisfied. So I really try to be good at the few things that are within my grasp and I razor focus.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Also, I graciously want to thank you for your service in fighting for our country. I want to mention that Sherman served in the U.S. Marines for 12 years. And I could go on and on and on your background. It's really, really incredible. I just want to say he received an honorable discharge at the rank of Chief Warrant Officer after a career-ending injury while preparing to deploy to Operation Enduring Freedom with 1st Marine Division. In 2004, you began your career in the veteran advocacy as an accredited representative for veterans, dependents, and survivors. You later worked as an appellate representative for the Board of Veterans Appeals in Washington, D.C. Shortly after, you joined the Paralyzed Veterans of America as an associate executive director of Veterans Benefit. I could go on and on. I'm so blown away with your background, and I thank you for your service. And, and I want to ask you a question about that. You know, I was at a football game recently and went before the pandemic, and there was these 4 gentlemen who'd been in the service. And I asked him, I said, how does it feel when people go, yeah, we thank you for your service, but it's really not genuine. Do you feel that way sometimes?
I think I used to in the beginning because there is a real resentment among those of us who get out under non-ideal circumstances where we see the public going on with their lives. They're just moving on. You don't even hear about what's happening overseas while there's actually, danger for a lot of people. And we go feeling like the public is so disconnected from these, even stateside, even on the bases. You know, there are people doing some hard, dangerous training and people are dying in this training. My daughter's at the Naval Academy right now, and I stay invested in what she's doing because I don't want to become detached like I've seen society. But at the same time, as you mature into your identity as a veteran and become an advocate, you realize that you couldn't do this work but for communities that support you. When we think about the Vietnam veterans who came home and were actually spit on, this isn't that, And I really love it when it's a stranger who just comes up and just walks away. They don't want to come in because this is sort of the paradox here. Now, when you get those folks that want to come in, they want to hear everything. We call it kind of trauma porn. You know, they want to hear all the ways that you were blown up. Did you kill anybody?
I've never heard that term.
But it is because they want to know every waking detail about everything. And when you're in line with your kid, you don't want to talk about all the ways that you were, you do so much to try to forget it that for people to walk up and treat it like it's an open conversation. And they precede it with thank you for your service. It's almost like it's for them so they can have a story to go tell somebody. But when you get that mom with her little son, it'll be a veteran, a World War II veteran who are the true heroes with the hat on and everything. It'll be a woman who doesn't, who's probably a grandma that served in some past era. And they'll just say it and walk away. I really appreciate that because then they're doing it for the individual, not for themselves. And those are the circumstances under which I most appreciate shows of gratitude.
That's wonderful. You know, on the Today Show today, they had a swearing in of becoming a U.S. citizen. And it was pretty empowering to watch that because many people don't realize this. We have a global team, and one of them is in Pakistan and one of them is in Serbia. Yeah. As a matter of fact, many of you know Jasmina, and she is in Serbia. She's one of the best people I have on my staff. So I just wanted you to know that. But, you know, we take for granted what we have here and we forget. And yeah, it's people like you that, you know, we wouldn't have it if you didn't do it. So thank you. So I wanted to ask you, one of the things that people write to us and they say, I say, you know, what do you want to hear on the podcast? They always want to know about failure and how you come through that. And I always say we've all faced failure. And if you haven't, you might. And it's how you get through it. It's how you respond to it. But can you share with us, have you ever faced failure and how you've kind of come through that?
You know, there was a time when I'd give the standard textbook answer. My failure is, you know, something that's gratuitous and self-aggrandizing. I embrace failure because that's the only way I've learned every lesson. I'll give you an example. We're on the heels of the Chauvin trial, and we do a lot of talking to people about the thin blue line. And I gave somebody an analogy. I said, you know, I remember being a drill instructor, and I did see instances where my fellow DIs went too far. But it was my moral failing to never report them. It was just my failing. I didn't want to endanger my career. I felt loyalty, even when it was clearly wrong. And this is years ago, and these people, nobody died or anything like that. But I understand that wall of silence better than a lot of people. And it makes it hard for me to be judgmental. But if I hadn't had that moral failing, I wouldn't be a better person right now, because I can now look at police officers and the people that are impacted, like human beings that are caught in a situation where we haven't given them enough resources to deal with folks with mental illness. So I diagnose the problem a lot differently because I failed, and I admit to that failure. I own it. And I talk to young people about it. You know, it's okay to be a little bit vulnerable and to have things you admit to. As long as you learn, right? As long as you get better.
It's how you respond to it. Mm-hmm.
So that's really at the end of it. In any job interview I've ever said it, I gladly talk about, you know, blind spots that I suffered with employees. Maybe I started an initiative where I didn't talk to enough people. I've got a litany of those to go with all the successes. That's the only way you get anything done. You just have to try things that you may fail.
So
I can sit all day and talk about those things, but I'd rather emphasize that failure is, you might even characterize it as you either succeed or you learn, right? You don't even have to say it's failure. It's just a consequence of being human. So that's about the extent to which I would advise anybody who's concerned about a perspective on failure.
Got it. So I love that. Thank you for that. I wanted to ask you something that I've actually witnessed this past week, and I think a lot of people do. And I wanted to kind of get a perspective from NAMI in terms of what people should do in these situations. So I was on the board of CASA for 12 years, which is Court Appointed Special Advocates. They finally kicked me off after 12 years because I served my terms. And but it changed my life. It helped me be aware of child abuse. Many times parents, stress takes over, right? And so many resources that NAMI provides. Thank you for that. But today, there's women and men in this pandemic. Divorces are happening. Abuse is happening when we don't know it. It was interesting. This sounds a little crazy, but I was getting my nails done a couple weeks ago, and this girl, they were from Vietnam, I believe, and she was so sweet. And I said, "What are you drinking?" And she said, "I'm drinking a Starbucks strawberry refresher, whatever." And I said, "I'm going to order me one." And I did that. And she said, I just ordered you one. And I went, "What?" And she goes, "You're my friend." And so many times we forget the kindness is right. And I returned the favor. But I've seen where there's some kind of like people are struggling, and you know, there's a situation going on. And I noticed that I felt like there was some abuse going on with another person around her. You know, in those situations, you know, many people walk away Many people say something. What is, I spoke to the person's friend later, but in those situations, it's sure easy to walk away.
Yeah.
But you also don't want to be offensive and intrude. So, what do you guys recommend? Because, I think we've all been there at one time in our life. And with child abuse, I've always said, don't ever walk away. If you see a child being abused, do what you got to do. But just like you mentioned in what you said about not reporting, what do you recommend in those situations?
This is so tough because there are oftentimes cultural implications. There's that idea that, you can go too far or if you make a mistake and you misread something.
Correct.
But it's really about your obligation as a human being to risk some of that. If you sincerely think in your mind that there's somebody who cannot defend him or herself in a situation where there might be a question, I would personally start with the individual and let them know you're worth being free from anything that oppresses you, whether it's a hardship that nobody, wants, you to talk about, or it's something that you think you're contributing to because of who you are in some way, but you're worth it and I'm here for you. And I think the beginning of that conversation has to be, I am here for you, because at some point they may reach out, but they have to know that that gate is open.
Yeah.
Now, if I feel the individual is in a position where it's a kind of an imprisonment scenario and it's a younger kid, I always err on the side of protecting human life. That's my bias as a Marine. We get involved. If I see something happening on the street, you can best believe I'm pulling over and I'm at least going to say something because I'm going to focus on the victim, the perceived victim, and say, what's going on here? Do you need help? And I've done that many times in my, so many years after I got out of the Marine Corps, because I feel like as a citizen, this is how you help the police. This is how you relieve them from having to be the social workers and everything else. And then you just sort of moderate your involvement by what makes sense in the moment. So it's hard to let something go by and not do something when you've served in the military or been on the front lines of any first responder career, or even in what you do, or you're reaching out and educating the public. It's hard to sit and watch that.
Yeah. Well, and to follow up. So the next time I went, I was talking to her and I brought her a gift card and said, thank you so much for your kindness. And I said, how you doing? And it was funny. Our last guest with WebMD was a chief medical officer, Dr. White. And he said they have a campaign call that they say, how are you doing really? And so I hugged her and I said, how you doing really? And tears came to her eyes. And she said, my husband's been in AA for 3 months and it's hard. And I said, well, here's my number. I'm always here. And so it's those little things, but I think you hit on it. If you truly feel there's something going on, you're probably right. Just be careful.
Yeah.
You gotta be careful. You don't want to intrude, So I really, really appreciate that. Because I think more people walk away
and I'll just say this as a closing thought. And if I'm wrong, I'm glad I'm wrong. Right. If I find out that
absolutely,
it was a sunburn and not a bruise,
amen to that. I love that.
I just want you to know that I care about you and I'm glad I'm wrong, and I'll buy you dinner. I'll be glad to be wrong. But the problem is we know it happens more often than we think.
Yeah.
So what are the chances that you see something, you feel like something's wrong, and you're going to be that 1% or whatever that percentage is where it was an innocent something or other?
Amen to that. I love that. So I could talk to you all day and I'm so inspired by you. But I have a question. Who inspires you?
Who inspires me? I think that a lot of people do in different ways. My wife is now embarked on a career in archaeology. So she's starting after she raised kids, she served in Afghanistan herself.
Wow.
And so she's found a new love in something that gives her purpose. I think that inspires me to see her go through that evolution. My son, who I've been homeschooling along with my wife for the last year, his resiliency, his little resiliency. And I'm not making excuses, because he's got to do what he's got to do. And we all got to do what we have to do. So I think my family is at the center of that. But ultimately, my grandmother and grandfather have always been my lifelong. She was an English teacher back when, a lot of women who walked in her skin didn't achieve those milestones. And my grandfather served in the Korean War and just worked an honest living and raised three daughters. And I pattern myself after those two individuals to to be the best person I can, because they kind of sit on my shoulder.
I love that. And
even in their transition, they've been in my ear.
I love that. Well, I've learned so much about, number one, you, but about your organization. And we'll certainly be promoting that along during the month of May as well, because, there's a better place.
Yeah.
Right. There's whatever you're going through. If you're listening to this, check out NAMI.org. There is a better place and there is support and you will get through this. So I have one last question for you. So Mr. Gillums Jr., mm-hmm. when you get in your car and you're going to that meeting and you've got to have game on, you're doing a presentation or maybe it's this interview or whatever, but you've got to have game on. What is the song or the genre or the band or the name of a song that gets you focused, that brings you game on, that says, I got this? Is there any song that comes to mind?
There have been many, but Rise Up, definitely.
Rise Up.
There's a song called Rise Up. It's one of the best, get revved up songs that I've heard in a long time, because a lot of us are doing just that. We're rising up despite all that's happening to us.
And I rise up.
Wow. Well, like I said, I could talk to you forever. Thank you so much for being on our podcast. I know this is going to help so many people and they're going to be inspired. And anybody who didn't know who NAMI is will certainly know now. So thank you again for being on our podcast.
Thank you, Angela.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Refocus, the Creative Office. They create all of their products through the eyes of a child with ADHD. They create products that help you focus and refocus. Do you ever forget your passwords? I forget my passwords all the time. They have over 11 versions of password books. They've got large, they've got mini, they've got left-handed versions, and they just came out with two brand new camouflage versions in green and pink. Hopefully these products are going to help you focus and make your life better. Have a great week.